Do your patients know what presbyopia is?
There are people who are afraid of the press.
Have you talked to your patients about multifocal contact lenses?
I've heard the bifocal, but not
right,
multifocal.
Right, definitely not multifocal.
Do you need help with your multifocal strategy? Learn more at the conclusion of this episode.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack. Damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with MicroMicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and MicroMicell technology.
With more screen usage and indoor time, myopia, also known as nearsightedness, is increasing and getting worse in children. Now, certified eye doctors can prescribe MySight One Day, the first and only FDA-approved soft contact lens to slow myopia progression in age-appropriate children. Visit CooperVision.com to find a Brilliant Futures certified eye doctor near you. Hello and welcome to the Open Your Eyes podcast. I'm Dr. Kerry Gelb, the host of the documentary Open Your Eyes. If you're new here and you like our interviews, press like, subscribe, share, and hit the bell to get notifications of great new interviews. Also, please leave comments. Great news, you can now watch our full-length documentary, Open Your Eyes, on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube movies and shows. And please share your thoughts by emailing me at drkerrygelb@gmail.com. That's drkerrygelb@gmail.com. And visit my website, drkerrygelb.com. Most people don't realize that the body's liver has over 500 functions. When people think about disease prevention or chronic disease, they think brain, heart, and cancer. Rarely is the extremely important liver ever mentioned. Today's guest is liver specialist Dr. Steven Zucker. Dr. Zucker is a member of the faculty of the Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Endoscopy at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He also has an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Zucker is a well-known speaker, educator, and researcher in the field of liver disease. Dr. Zucker, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
You know, Dr. Zucker, my goal is to shed light on liver disease and what we could do to prevent, treat, and at least slow the progression of this serious but seemingly unappreciated disease, not only by the public, but even by physicians. Why do you think that may be?
People who have liver disease tend to get stigmatized. There's an assumption if you hear that someone has a liver problem that they either drink too much alcohol or they use drugs. And so once you stereotype the disease, it becomes very hard to look past that.
Interesting. Now, people don't realize, but from last I saw, liver disease is now the seventh leading cause of death in the United States, and it's increasing every year. Can you go over some of the epidemiology of how many people have liver disease and if those statistics that I mentioned are correct?
That is largely correct. There are estimated to be about 4.5 million individuals in the United States who suffer from some form of liver disease, and a proportion of them will go on to develop cirrhosis of the liver, estimated about 600,000 in the United States. The reason that liver disease tends to be increasing, or the trend has been increasing, is because there's certain disorders that are increasing in frequency. The main one being what we call metabolic fatty liver disease. It's estimated that as many as 30% of the U.S. population has metabolic fatty liver, and that has been increasing with the obesity epidemic. So that's one of the main reasons. The other is that alcohol use has been increasing in the United States, and alcohol-related liver disease has been increasing as well.
Of the people who get fatty liver disease, which you said is about 30, 30% of the U.S. population. Why are they getting fatty liver disease?
Well, there's a number of risk factors for fatty liver, one of the main ones being obesity. And in general, in the United States, there's a trend towards increasing weight. But also other risk factors include diabetes, high blood pressure, high lipid levels like cholesterol, triglycerides. All of those are commonly associated with fatty liver.
So fatty liver is also called NASH. Is that correct?
Correct. So there's been a change in terminology. It used to be called non-alcoholic fatty liver, but that terminology, the sort of a negative terminology, was thought not to be as descriptive. So now it's called metabolic dysfunction associated liver disease, or MASH is a short abbreviation.
Now that we have 30% because of, you know, our diet, I would assume that the American diet is so poor. Of those 30%, what percent could go on to get cirrhosis, very severe liver disease?
It's estimated that 5 to 10% of patients who have metabolic fatty liver will go on to develop cirrhosis. So it's a sizable number of individuals. And the scary part about it is that it frequently is asymptomatic. So I will see individuals who present when they have a complication of their liver disease. And when I go back and look at their records, it was clear that they had this ongoing for decades.
Now, there are some doctors that when you come into their office, they'll do some type of scan to see if you have fatty liver. What's the name of that scan and how useful is that?
I believe you're referring to something called a FibroScan. And what it is, it's a technique called elastography. And what it's exactly like it sounds. It measures how elastic the liver is. There are several ways to do that, but the one that we use, the FibroScan, is very convenient because it's office-based. It takes 5 minutes to do it. It doesn't hurt. It's very simple. And so we can have people walk into the office and within 5 minutes can give them feedback on how fatty the liver is and how stiff the liver is, which roughly correlates to scarring or damage within the liver.
So fatty liver is part of metabolic disease, you know, the American diet. Can we reverse fatty liver without drugs through natural ways?
Yes, for sure. So it's been clearly shown the most effective treatment for metabolic fatty liver is weight loss. And in the rule of thumb is loss of 10% of your body weight from the time of diagnosis will not only prevent disease progression, but will actually result in regression of the fatty liver, and it can result in regression of any scarring that's in the liver. So you can see substantial improvement.
So when we have a metabolic syndrome, we have the big belly, we have elevated triglycerides, low HDL, high LDL, the blood pressure is starting to creep up a little bit, the blood sugar is starting to creep up. So will people get fatty liver before they become insulin resistant or diabetic or even become diabetic, or do they typically get it after, or everybody's different?
Well, there's a little bit of variability in that, but I will say that many patients will have some degree of insulin resistance or what we call pre-diabetes. So you don't necessarily need to be overtly diabetic, but if you have pre-diabetes, that is a predisposing factor to developing fatty liver.
And what do you think are the worst foods to cause fatty liver?
Well, what we tell patients, so the real bad guys are the refined or processed carbohydrates. So foods with high fructose corn syrup in them, all the yummy stuff, the sweets are really the bad guys. But other things that people don't necessarily think about are white bread, white rice, pasta, sugary drinks like sodas. Those are they contribute substantially to the development of fatty liver.
So when we put somebody on a diet for fatty liver, obviously we're going to eliminate those. Is there any specific foods that you want people to eat?
Well, you can eat most foods. In fact, the diet that's been studied the most in fatty liver and is recommended by many of the major societies is the Mediterranean diet. I like that diet and I do recommend it to my patients because it's not very restrictive. It is enriched in fruits and vegetables and de-enriched in those processed carbohydrates, but it's something that is not terribly difficult to follow. And for that reason, I think it's an effective diet. Other diets work, so you can use almost any of the diets, the paleo diet, the Atkins diet. Those are effective, but they're just much harder to maintain. And it really is a lifestyle modification. You need to do this long term in order to have benefit.
And how about becoming a vegan?
Absolutely. So a vegetarian or vegan diet can work very well for fatty liver. Many of my patients, they'll wince if I bring that up, but it is an effective way to lose weight.
I want to talk about high fructose corn syrup for a minute. I have a patient who comes in with a big bottle of soda every time he comes in, and he's drinking like a pint of soda every day. And I've had other patients that drink soda three, four, five times a day with all that high fructose corn syrup. Tell me about that.
Well, that's been clearly shown to trigger fat accumulation in the liver. And those are things definitely to avoid if you want to have a healthy liver. But they also contribute to weight gain and diabetes. So it's not just purely the liver that becomes problematic for people who drink a lot or take in a lot of that high fructose corn syrup.
Now we're talking a lot about the liver, but for the people out there, what are some of the most important functions of the liver?
So the liver, I tell people that it does three main things. One of them is that it controls your body's metabolism. So everything that you eat flows through the liver, and then the liver sort of directs where those different metabolites go. And so it really is the regulator of your entire body's metabolism. In addition, the liver is a filter for your blood. So during our normal metabolism, we produce compounds that are toxic, and the liver's job is to filter them out. It also filters drugs and other, medications and other things. And then the third main function is it helps you digest food, particularly fats. It produces bile, which is very important for fat digestion.
And how about vitamins? How are vitamins related with the liver? Does the liver make vitamins, or does the liver extract vitamins and give it to the body?
It does a little of that. So the liver, for instance, is very important in vitamin D metabolism and can help with maintaining strong bones. So people with liver disease do have increased risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis. That is the main vitamin. Vitamin A is stored in the liver. So you can run into trouble either with low or high levels of vitamin A as well. And vitamin K does play a role in the liver, which is part of your clotting mechanism.
One of the things I'm fascinated is albumin, that the liver makes albumin and gives the body protein. I don't think people understand that. And if you could explain that whole concept.
So albumin is the main protein in your blood. And the liver is the only organ that makes the protein. So if your liver is sick, you can have low levels of albumin. If you have low levels, that can result in a number of problems. But one of the biggest ones is that albumin maintains your body's volume status. So fluid, if you don't have enough albumin, will leak out of your vessels and you'll end up accumulating in your tissues. So you can get swollen all over your body, including in your abdomen as well. So it's an important protein in that regard. It also transports a lot of any compound that's in your blood that is not dissolved very well in water is usually bound to albumin. So it's an important transport protein for various compounds in the blood.
And if the liver is starting to be under stress and it's not making as much albumin as it should, what could happen to the patient?
Well, one of the big ones is you get the term we use is edematous, but basically it means you get a lot of fluid in all your tissues. So you get swelling in your arms, your legs, your abdomen. That's one of the big problems that you run into. The other is that when you are deficient in protein, then your body looks to try to pull protein from other parts. And the main source of protein is your muscles. So people who have chronic liver disease and low albumin, they tend to get muscle wasting and weakness in the muscles. That can be a big problem.
And how big is the liver compared to other organs? And how much blood does the liver have in it at one time? And where is it located?
So the liver is in your abdominal cavity. It's what we call the right upper quadrant of the abdominal cavity. So it's tucked under the rib cage, just below the diaphragm. And it's your second largest organ. I could challenge you and ask you what your largest is. Most people get it wrong.
The skin, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the skin is your largest organ. The liver is number two. So it's very big. It's bigger than your brain or your heart or your lungs. There's a sizable amount of blood that passes through your liver. It's estimated that 20% of your blood volume is contained within the liver. And it's interesting, the liver is the only blood organ that has a dual blood supply. So it has both a portal vein and a hepatic artery that provide blood flow to it.
You know, when we look at the causes of liver disease, and we talked a little bit about fatty liver before, let's talk about alcohol. I mean, people listening to this, they're going to want to know about alcohol. And tell us about how alcohol hurts the liver. And when does it start hurting? And is it reversible if you have liver disease, liver damage?
So, number of questions in that one.
Yeah.
So what I tell patients is that alcohol injures everybody's liver. So it is toxic to your liver cells. And if you drink enough of it, it will cause damage to anybody's liver. The general rule is that for men, you should not drink more than two drinks a day. In women, that's one drink a day to be at safe levels of ingestion of alcohol. But there's a lot of variability in between individuals. Some people, you've seen it, they can drink a case of beer a day and nothing seems to happen to them. And then people who drink much more modestly can get into a lot of trouble. And a lot of that has to do with how well your body metabolizes the alcohol. And so one of the main locations is in your stomach. So you drink the alcohol, the lining of the stomach has alcohol dehydrogenase, which metabolizes the alcohol. And so a lot of it doesn't get into your system. People who have lower levels of alcohol dehydrogenase in the blood get higher blood, in the stomach, get higher blood alcohol levels. And so they are more susceptible to injury from alcohol. So women tend to have lower alcohol dehydrogenase levels than men, which is why the general rule is they shouldn't drink as much as men. But it's also true across different ethnic groups that have different levels of alcohol dehydrogenase. And a good example of that is people who've had a gastric bypass. So when you've undergone a gastric bypass, basically your stomach is about this big. And so you cannot metabolize alcohol hardly at all. And so people who've had a gastric bypass are exquisitely sensitive and can develop liver damage even from very modest alcohol ingestion.
Now, is there any way to add alcohol dehydrogenase to your body?
Great question. Not that I'm aware of.
heard it.
But you'd probably make a fortune if you could figure out how to do that.
I figured I had to ask that. What, of all the liver transplants, what percentage of people with alcohol liver disease wind up that need a transplant?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if I can answer it because we don't know the denominator. What I can say is that alcohol is really the second leading cause for liver transplant in the United States. So there's a sizable proportion of people where alcohol is the cause of their liver disease and liver damage. But even beyond that, even if you don't, if alcohol is not the primary cause, it will exacerbate any other liver condition. So, for example, if you have hepatitis C, a viral infection of the liver, if you drink significant levels of alcohol, it triples the rate of progression to cirrhosis. And so you have to be careful, particularly if you have an underlying liver condition, to be very modest in alcohol intake.
MacuHealth, your science-born and tested solutions for visual performance, macular degeneration, and dry eye syndrome. New products coming soon. Embrace the science.
Now, I'm going to ask you to define the difference between hepatitis and cirrhosis in a minute, but people with hepatitis or cirrhosis, I think you kind of answered this, can they have any alcohol?
It's always a hard question. I think I am not someone who says you have to be completely abstinent. Some of my colleagues would disagree with me, but you want to be very modest. So there are some data to give us evidence for that. The best data are in people who have the metabolic fatty liver. There's always a question. Can I drink alcohol? How much can I drink? And there was one study where they did those FibroScans that we talked about earlier, and they followed people longitudinally. So they did a FibroScan every year for 5 years. And these are people with metabolic fatty liver, but they stratified them by how much alcohol they drank. And what the study basically showed is the more you drank, the steeper your progression of your liver scarring. But those people who drank 3 drinks or less a week did not progress any faster than those who drank none. And that is the basis for my recommendation to patients is no more than 3 drinks a week.
Interesting. That's great advice. I saw a statistic that NASH will soon be the number one cause of needing a liver transplant, if it's not already.
I think it already is in many, in, you know, it's obviously regionally dependent, but in general, in many regions, MASH is the number one reason for transplant.
Right. I got to stop saying NASH. I got to start saying MASH.
Yeah.
talk about viral. Let's start with the difference between cirrhosis and hepatitis.
That I really like that question because I think it's a profound one. And it's a very important one because even a lot of physicians don't really understand this. So hepatitis, any word in medicine that ends in itis means inflammation. And so the hepar is your liver. So hepatitis means an inflamed liver. And that's really all it means. It's just like when you have appendicitis, your appendix is inflamed. But there are many, many causes of hepatitis or inflammation in the liver. The way you know somebody has hepatitis is by measuring your, looking at the blood tests, because there are certain blood tests that are elevated when your liver is inflamed. The main ones being your ALT and your AST. And those are proteins that are normally reside in your liver cells. When the liver cells become injured or damaged from inflammation, they leak out and your levels go up. So people with hepatitis have elevated liver enzymes. Cirrhosis is a result of chronic inflammation in the liver. So what cirrhosis is basically scar, a lot of scar in your liver. And any liver disease can ultimately lead to cirrhosis. So cirrhosis itself is not a clinical condition. It's a result of some type of liver injury. And so that really refers to how much scarring there is in the liver.
You know, we all hear that the liver is able to regenerate and repair itself. At what point can the liver repair, and at one point is it past the point of being able to repair itself?
Well, that's a super great question as well. So the liver is incredibly resilient, and we know, so it used to be thought that if you have a scar, it's a scar. So if you have cirrhosis, you have cirrhosis, and that's the end of it. But what we know is that if you treat whatever condition is causing the scarring in the liver, that you can get regression of that scarring. And it doesn't really matter what the disease is. So for example, if you have hepatitis C and hepatitis C has caused cirrhosis, if I treat your hepatitis C and cure you of that, you can get significant regression of the scar, the damage in the liver that's already there. That's true for metabolic fatty liver. If you lose weight, then you can see regression of scarring. If you drink a lot of alcohol and you stop drinking, you can see regression. So the question is really, when is the point of no return? And that is not, there's not a clear line there. What we do know is that there's a, your liver has a lot of reserve capacity, and so it has a lot of ability to recover. But if you damage it enough, then it won't be able to do that. And the example I use is that if you take a rat and you chop out 80% of their liver, you sew them back up, the liver regenerates, the rat, you know, does fine. But if you take out 85% of the liver, they die. And so there is a line that if you cross it, then it's the liver will not recover from that point. But it's hard to define it in a given individual exactly when that is.
When you're examining a patient, can you get a feel for whether or not you think they'll be able to reverse it, you know, as a liver specialist? Or you say, you know, I think you'll get better, I'm positive you're going to get better, you can't get better, you're definitely going to need a transplant.
So there are ways to tell that. Most of it has to do, so Cirrhosis itself is when you have a lot of scar in your liver. But what we talk about is whether the cirrhosis is compensated or not. If it's compensated, so even though you have a lot of scar in your liver is doing everything it's supposed to do, and that's compensated liver disease. So you may not even know you have it because you feel pretty well and the liver's working fine. When you have decompensated liver disease, the liver stops working well. And when that happens, the wheels start to come off the cart and you start to see manifestations of that. And there's many. For example, you can get confusion because your liver is a filter. And if it's not filtering your blood well, ammonia can build up and that will cause mental confusion. You can develop fluid in the abdomen, and that's due to high pressures in the liver from the scarring that's there. And then you develop what we call ascites, and that's a manifestation of the liver failing. The other manifestations can be large blood vessels that develop in your esophagus, and you can have bleeding from that, which can be very severe and significant. So there's a variety of things that can happen to patients that will indicate that the liver function is not good. And once you lose your function, that can be not always recoverable.
Have you ever seen somebody who became jaundiced and lost some of the, had elevated, you know, had jaundice and maybe have grade one, stage one, varices? And have you seen any people like that ever recover any of, or decrease their fibrosis?
Absolutely. So I'll give you an example. I saw one of my patients today, and when I first saw him, he had hepatitis C, and he had ascites. He had fluid. He was needing to have fluid sucked out of his abdomen periodically for comfort. He had varices and actually bled from them. So they were great. They were the large ones, and confusion. And I treated his hepatitis C. And over the course of the next year, his liver function completely recovered. The fluid went away. His veins in his esophagus got better. His mental status cleared up. So yes, you can see a dramatic recovery. So sometimes it's a little hard to predict up front.
And we're going to talk about some of these other things also, but could that also happen with somebody who has primary biliary cholangitis, and can they recover?
So that one's a little bit more difficult. So there are different disorders of the liver, but primary biliary cholangitis is a disorder that we can treat fairly well to prevent progression. But once you've developed progression, it's hard to pull patients back. So that is a little bit of a different scenario. Most diseases, you can see substantial recovery. That one, it's a little less common.
And we're going to get into that a little bit in detail in a little bit. But if you could go through hepatitis A, B, and C, just so the audience could understand the difference between the three, which is the most serious, the least serious, which could be cured or treated well.
Sure. So they all can be serious. So I don't want to negate any of them, but they're quite different. Hepatitis A is a foodborne infection. So if you go to a restaurant and the lettuce is contaminated, or someone working there has hepatitis and doesn't wash their hands well, you get it because you get it by eating it. The thing about hepatitis A is that it's self-limited. So if you get it, you get sick, you feel awful, you can turn jaundiced, but you'll recover. And generally, there's no sequelae. Rarely, it will be very severe, and it does kill occasionally a person, but that's very uncommon. And typically, it's someone who has other medical issues that put them at higher risk. Hepatitis B is sexually transmitted, excuse me, or it's transmitted by blood. And so people who are at risk for hepatitis B are people who are having unprotected sex with people that, with a lot of partners, people who are incarcerated, prostitutes, people like myself who or yourself who work in the medical field and are exposed to blood. Those are people that are potentially at risk. So there are ways to mitigate that much easier than hepatitis A. I should say for both A and B, there are effective vaccines that will prevent you from getting infected. Currently, there is all children are vaccinated against both. Hepatitis A only started recently, so many people are not vaccinated. Hepatitis B vaccine started, ooh, I would say, at least 30 years ago. So most people who are 30 years or younger have been vaccinated against that. But both those vaccines are very effective. Hepatitis C is a viral infection that is mostly acquired from contaminated blood. It's actually fairly difficult to transmit sexually. So you see it a lot, mostly in people who use IV drugs, or rarely it can be sexually transmitted. There's effective treatment for that now. But there is no effective vaccine, so there's no way to prevent someone from getting it. But the treatment now is extremely effective.
Let's talk about medications that could hurt the liver, whether it's statins, allopurinol. Everyone wants to know about acetaminophen or Tylenol. Tell us about which are the big ones that we have to watch out for.
So the number one cause of drug-induced liver injury is Tylenol, acetaminophen. Half of all drug-induced liver injury, at least half, is due to Tylenol. So Tylenol, it is toxic if you take enough of it. Any person will have liver damage if you take enough Tylenol. So the two things you need to be aware of, you'll see it if someone attempts to harm themselves by taking a lot of it, or unintentionally, but taking a lot of it over an extended period of time. So we'll see patients who come in and they have a lot of pain and they've been taking medicine, either Tylenol or medicine containing Tylenol, and they've been doing it for days and days and days and days. That can eventually cause liver toxicity as well. Beyond the Tylenol, the next most common causes of drug-induced liver injury are antibiotics. That's number two. And there's a number of antibiotics that do that. The Augmentin is a big one. Some of the tuberculosis medications will do it. Nitrofurantoin is common. That's used for urinary tract infections. Those are sort of the big ones. And then number three, which a lot of people don't realize, are herbal medications. I hear patients all the time that say, "Oh, if this is natural, it's not going to harm me." But that's actually not true, is that natural compounds can be harmful just as well. So you need to be very careful about the stuff you buy on the internet.
And how about statins and allopurinol? We have a lot of people on statins in our country and a lot of people with gout that are on allopurinol. How
Yeah.
big of a risk are those?
Yeah, statins. So there are two things that statins do. They can cause very mild liver test elevations, and in general, you don't need to stop them if they're very mild. The general rule is if they're less than three times the upper limit of normal, you have to balance how bad do you need the statin. If you have a coronary stent and that's preventing you from having a heart attack, then the statins become very important, and mild liver test elevations are secondary. You can get more severe elevations in liver tests, and sometimes that requires stopping statins. I do see that, periodically, but it's relatively uncommon. What people don't know is that if you have cirrhosis, statins have been shown to reduce the risk of disease progression and reduce your risk of developing cancer in your liver. So there are some benefits for statins, and we do not, as hepatologists, tell patients not to take them if they need them.
And would you put people on a statin that have cirrhosis to decrease?
There are a number, pretty good data that that's a good idea, particularly in metabolic fatty liver, where a lot of my colleagues will do just that.
You know, I have a story that many years ago, I was much younger. I was examining this patient, and you know, he was always came in well dressed. He was some kind of salesman. I forgot what he sold. It's been many years now, and he wore contact lenses. And back then, before the daily contact lenses, they had these contact lens cases with the wells.
Oh yeah.
And he would say to me, "Oh, Dr. Gelb, I use this to snort, you know, for drugs and snort cocaine." And not far after that, you know, obviously we had a discussion about the dangers of that, but he didn't take it to heart. And he came in not long after with ascites of his belly and severe liver disease. And, you know, I've haven't seen him in a long time. He's passed away. But can those type of drugs cause liver disease? You know, that was a one-off case.
Yeah, so it's probably not directly the drug, but you can develop hepatitis. Many of those, they're contaminated. And so through your nasal mucosa, particularly, you can acquire hepatitis B or hepatitis C. So there are ways that you can get infected, and that will lead to liver disease. You know, a lot of people are sharing things, and so you get cross-contamination.
How about toxic chemicals, you know, being exposed to chemicals being a contributor to liver disease?
Well, there are certainly well-documented types of exposures that clearly cause liver disease. Vinyl chloride is a good example. People who work with vinyl chloride have a high risk of liver issues and specific cancers in the liver. But yes, the short answer is you can develop liver injury from certain types of toxic exposures. The literature is not robust there, but absolutely, there are a number of chemicals that can lead to liver damage.
And vinyl chloride is something used to make plastics, I believe. So I want to move on to the next category, autoimmune hepatitis. And apparently that's pretty well treated now with prednisone. But take us through autoimmune hepatitis. Why do people get it? Do we know? And exactly what it is?
Ooh. Well, so what I tell my patients about autoimmune hepatitis is that it's sort of like having rheumatoid arthritis, but of the liver. So like in rheumatoid arthritis, your immune system, for reasons that are unclear, goes haywire and starts attacking your joints. Well, the same thing can happen with your liver. That's what autoimmune hepatitis is. So your immune system goes haywire and attacks the liver. So the way you treat it is to suppress your immune response. And that's where, as you mentioned, prednisone can come in. Usually we don't leave people on prednisone just because it has a lot of long-term consequences, side effects. But in the short term, it's very effective. And then usually we'll transition to a maintenance drug. So the good news about autoimmune hepatitis is that it's very treatable, like you said, and it's very unusual to have people who are diagnosed early to develop any problems down the line. But it does require lifelong therapy, and the therapy does have some side effects too. What causes it? You can win the Nobel Prize if you figure that one out. There's usually every decade or so, there's this theory that comes out on how it occurs. The current one is that they think there's a predisposition. So if you look, there's certain genetic markers that are more common in people who develop it, and they tend to have immune problems, different types of immune problems like thyroid disease, rheumatoid arthritis in themselves or their relatives. But then there's some trigger that sets the immune system off. And what we don't know is what that trigger actually is.
And what would some of the symptoms be of somebody with autoimmune hepatitis B?
Well, frequently, the scary part is that it's frequently asymptomatic, and that it's picked up. Most of the time it's picked up when someone checks lab tests and notice that the liver tests are elevated. sometimes with a very abrupt flare, people will feel sick, but it's usually nonspecific, just not feeling well. Maybe they have a little bit of abdominal discomfort, but not something dramatic usually.
And with autoimmune hepatitis, there's a big variation in how long you're going to live if you treat it versus non-treatment. Is that correct?
Generally, all patients require treatment. Once you make the diagnosis, treatment is required. I tell patients, expect to take it lifelong. It used to be thought that people could come off of therapy, and there's some data that a very small subset of patients might be able to, but the vast majority, if you stop treatment, they will flare. So we just continue it lifelong.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack. Damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with Micromycel, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and Micromycel technology.
Fitting multifocal contact lenses presents a big opportunity to meet patient needs while growing your practice. Alcon is your partner not only with our innovative portfolio, but through e-learning. Learn to enhance your multifocal strategy today with the Alcon Experience Academy.
OIE Broadcasting is the emerging leader in social media. We use scientific entertainment to drive more patients into your office. Visit OIEBroadcasting.com and sign up today.